Okay, this is now talk number 8, I think the final talk in the series on forgiving others, what it does and doesn't involve. So let's look at the question of what about reporting a fellow believer to the police or giving evidence against a fellow believer in a criminal case? Now, the thing which Paul prohibited in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 1 to 8, that was civil litigation against fellow Christians. He wasn't speaking about how we should or should not deal with criminal offences. That's where a Christian has committed a crime and another Christian is a witness or the injured party in that crime. That is an entirely different type of situation, because there is no reason in principle why a Christian should not report a crime to the police or to offer to be a witness in a criminal case. It is not what 1 Corinthians 6 is talking about. The first point to make is that a crime is entirely different from a civil dispute. So in the eyes of the law in the United Kingdom, all crime is committed against the Queen. And in other jurisdictions, crime is committed against the state. So even the direct victim of a crime is, technically speaking, only a witness. It's the Crown in the United Kingdom, or the state in other places, which is actually pursuing the offender. And it's the state, or the Crown, which decides whether to prosecute. Now, realising that fact changes everything, because the prosecuting authorities, whoever they may be, have all been put there by God so as to keep order and punish wrongdoing. So a crime is not a matter that's being pursued by an individual in the same way that a piece of civil litigation is, where the claimant or plaintiff is pursuing the matter for personal redress. In a criminal case, the Crown is seeking to punish a wrongdoer, because that's the job of the Crown, the job of the state to do that. And even the victim, as I say, is really not the centre of the matter. He's just a witness. Obviously an important witness, but just a witness nevertheless. Now, the prosecuting authorities are put there by God, and God wants them to deal with things and punish wrongdoing. That's what he wants them to do. Whether the people concerned, the accused or the witnesses or the injured party, whether they're Christians or not, it's irrelevant. And if that is so, then it must follow that for a Christian to cooperate with the state in bringing a prosecution is effectively to help God in to pursue his objectives. And that's one of the reasons why he appointed rulers and authorities in every nation. Apostle Paul speaks of this in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 to 5. He says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience." Now, I emphasize all this about what can or can't a Christian do in relation to being involved in a criminal case, because I once heard of a situation where a family in a church was put under pressure by a church leader not to go to the police when one of their own small children was sexually molested by a 17-year-old young man from another family in the church. Now, this family was told that it would not be right to involve the police in a church matter. And Paul's words from 1 Corinthians 6 were then quoted in support of that argument. But the church leader in that case, it was something I read about, but that church leader was quite wrong. He had no right to counsel the parents of the victim in that way. The parents were free to go to the police. Indeed, arguably, you could say they even had a duty to go, so as to protect other people's children. At any rate, the point is this: It was solely their decision, not the pastor's, as to whether or not to involve the police. It was a matter of conscience and depended on all the facts of the case and on all the circumstances and the personalities of the people concerned. And it was, above all, the operative point is this: it had nothing whatever to do with the situation that Apostle Paul is describing in 1 Corinthians 6, which is entirely about civil disputes between individuals. Paul isn't speaking in that chapter about criminal cases. Now, I once myself had to give evidence in a criminal prosecution against a person who used to be a fellow member of the church I was in. The story began when I gave a job to a woman. She was at a church of which I used to be a member. And the job that I gave her didn't last long because she turned out to be thoroughly lazy and dishonest and manipulative. I was really quite surprised by how useless she was. So I got rid of her after only about 1 month, and she didn't get through her probationary trial period. Now, to my surprise, some years later, I was contacted by the benefits agency, and they questioned me about this lady, and it turned out that she had been claiming unemployment benefits while she was working for me. In fact, she denied to the agency, the benefits agency, that she'd ever worked for me at all, although she'd worked for me for a month. And it turned out she'd done the same with several other employers too, working for them for a while, claiming benefits whilst earning wages. And therefore, the benefits agency brought a prosecution against her, and a number of managers from different companies, including me, were called as witnesses to give evidence against her in a criminal trial for benefit fraud. Now, although I found it very sad, I had no hesitation in signing a witness statement, dealing with what had happened and giving evidence against her. And I also went to the trial, although on the morning of the actual trial, she pleaded guilty at the last minute. And therefore, I didn't, in the end, actually need to give my evidence verbally. I'd already given it in a witness statement, but I didn't have to do it verbally in court. Nonetheless, I gave it, and I believe it was my civic duty to give evidence against her for the prosecution. It would have been entirely wrong for me to fail to do so merely because she was a Christian or claimed to be one. I don't even know whether she really was. Her behaviour was terrible. Now, one important point to note is that I was not giving evidence for my own sake. It wasn't for my benefit. If it had just been me suing her for something or other, that would have been my decision as to whether or not to do so. It would have been a civil case, and I could have looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 6 to decide whether she was a fellow believer and so forth, whether the church could deal with it and so on. Those would have been the questions. But this wasn't my case at all. This was a prosecution by the state-appointed authorities on behalf of the benefits agency. God had put those authorities in place to do justice, and Christians are just as subject to their authority as anybody else is. And therefore, we're all under the same duty to assist a prosecution by providing evidence, whether the accused is a Christian or not. But at any rate, we're free to do so, and we're not prohibited from doing so by 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Now, that said, although we're free, that doesn't mean that we're obliged to go to the police to report every crime or offence that we believe may have been committed by a fellow believer. That would be to define our duty much too highly. It's a matter of conscience and requires wisdom as to whether you report a matter based on all the facts, and as to whether you should or shouldn't report a matter to the police. The point is simply that you're not prevented from doing so by what Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. But by the way, I'm speaking of the situation in a country like the United Kingdom, which has honest judges and a largely and almost entirely honest police force. Now, I recognise that is not the case in every country, and that some people in the world will need to bear in mind the quality and level of integrity of the police and the legal system wherever they live in deciding whether or not, and if so, to what extent to cooperate with them. It may be futile or even dangerous to try to go to the police or to go to any court in certain countries in the world. I'm speaking only of my own part of the world, where the legal system and the police, at the moment at least, are honest and genuine and not corrupt. Now, what if you are in a position of authority yourself, but it's in a work context rather than in a church? So let's change the subject and consider how you should act if you yourself are a manager or a proprietor of a business. What if you've got staff who've done wrong and who need to be disciplined or even dismissed? How can that be handled vigorously and effectively whilst at the same time maintaining an attitude of forgiveness and even of mercy and grace rather than an attitude of seeking personal vengeance? How can we look at this and see how we should conduct ourselves? Now, if you are in such a position of authority, you are going to have to do what's necessary to fulfill your managerial duties. Now, sometimes that will have to mean punishing or dismissing the person. But even so, you need to do it with the right attitude. This is so important. And on many occasions, I've had to dismiss members of staff for various types of misconduct. And sadly, some of those were Christians, or they claimed to be. Now, when that happens, there can be a temptation to abuse your own position as a manager and to try to get even with the person, or even to take revenge or vengeance against them. And if that arises, that inclination or temptation to seek revenge has to be firmly resisted. We must do what is needed to fulfill our duty as a manager, but we must take no pleasure from it. And that's a difficulty which most of us have never had to encounter, because most of us are not bosses and managers. But it's a real problem for those who do have to face such issues. Now, most managers make the opposite mistake of dodging the confrontation and doing nothing about the misconduct. A minority of managers might go the other way and tackle wrongdoers, but in a vengeful, abusive way, seeking revenge, such that they become part of the problem themselves because of the carnal way that they're responding. Now, to achieve a balance whereby you act decisively and firmly, and yet without being vengeful or abusing your own position, is surprisingly difficult. And therefore, it's rare for managers even to attempt to discipline people, let alone to succeed in doing so in a godly and forgiving way, and in a righteous way. Now, another problem that you encounter in management, which is surprisingly difficult to deal with at times, is in relation to the giving of references for former staff. Now, I'm looking at all this in the context of how does a Christian deal with matters in a forgiving way without, and yet at the same time practically dealing with things. Now, if you've had to discipline or even dismiss an employee and then they get offered a job somewhere else, even years later, you'll find that the new employer writes to you seeking a detailed reference. Now, these reference requests present a real difficulty in terms of this issue of forgiveness, because you need to firstly tell no lies to the new employer and avoid misleading him, and yet also, secondly, you need to avoid the temptation to take revenge against the ex-member of staff by giving an unfairly harsh reference, or even an accurate reference which is correct, but where your underlying motive is to hit back at them by revealing the truth but in a vengeful way. Now, that is a problem I've faced, and I've try to be really careful and fastidious about dealing with everything in a right and proper way. But an example of how this arose was with an ex-member of staff. I'll give her the name Josephine. That's not her name. She claimed to be a Christian, and she worked for me many years ago and was a major disappointment. She was lazy. She had a poor attendance record. She was two-faced. She was untrustworthy. She was unfaithful. She wasn't a good worker at all. And in the end, I saw through her, and I was very glad when eventually she left voluntarily, because I was on the brink of beginning to deal with her in a disciplinary context. I think she probably knew that, and that's why she departed. It prevented me from having to discipline her or sack her. But then, sometime later, I think it might have been more than a year later, I got a letter asking for a reference request, sending a detailed questionnaire. Now that was a problem to me, because if I filled it in truthfully, she wouldn't get the job. Because if I was honest about her, I would have had to be very critical. Now, I couldn't tell lies about her, but at the same time, I didn't want to harm her, so I just didn't reply. I just didn't answer the letter. I hoped that the new employer just would forget about it and not chase me up. But the new employer didn't forget. They chased after me. So I told them then that I just didn't want to fill the form in without explaining why. That wasn't good enough, and that they weren't happy about that, so they obviously spoke to Josephine and said she couldn't get the job unless I gave a reference. So she then contacted me herself, pleading with me for a reference. And then she told me that she'd split up with her partner, it wasn't her husband, she was living with a man, and that she was wanting to move area and start again. She made no mention of her past misconduct and gave no apology for anything that she'd done. As with most people who behave badly, they don't see anything wrong with themselves, and they don't see any need to apologise or see anything wrong in their behaviour. So, having thought about it, I decided what I'd do is write a very brief reference letter, just giving the most basic details of salary and start date, end date, working for me. So I told no lies, but I tried really hard to avoid telling the truth about her, and avoid doing any harm, if I could avoid it. Now, this is one of the things that you come up against as a manager. It's how do you deal with these things? Being honest, having integrity, but without harming people if you can avoid it, and yet at the same time, without harming the new employer, and at the same time, avoiding any desire for vengeance. And so, your aim must be to remain professional and honest, yet with an attitude of forgiveness and perhaps even mercy and grace in some ways, when those are possible and appropriate, which is not always, because there are times when it actually becomes your duty to be much more frank with the new employer. That could arise where the ex-employee was so bad that you feel obliged to feel concerned for the welfare of the prospective employer who's about to take this person on, and for their staff, because you feel a sense of responsibility for them not to mislead them by your silence. So, even so, if you do tell the truth about the matter, you need to do it in such a way as to take no pleasure from it, from revealing the truth about that person, because that would be to take vengeance. So we must limit ourselves solely to doing our duty, but not indulge in the taking of any kind of vengeance, because that's not our proper place. It's not what we're to do. It's what we're commanded not to do. Okay, well, changing the subject, let's look at this issue of continuing to pray for those who've done you harm, even long afterwards. Now, we are commanded to pray for those who've harmed and abused us. Romans 12:14 says, "Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse." Now, there have been an awful lot of people who've done me harm over the years, possibly because I've had so many people working for me in the business, and also I've been in a number of churches. And to the best of my knowledge, I believe I don't feel any bitterness towards any of them, any of the people who've done me harm. For many of them, I've continued over the years, actually, to pray for their salvation. And if you've been wronged by someone, and yet you freely choose to forgive them, and even to become an intercessor for that person, praying for them, I believe it gives you a special standing with God on that, in relation to that person. And I think he's therefore more inclined to hear a prayer from you and to answer it, precisely because it's an unselfish prayer. The very motivation for it and the ability to make that prayer has very probably come from the Holy Spirit, not from yourself. And you therefore have a special status when you pray for people who've done you harm, because, which I think will cause your prayer to be heard. Such a prayer, you could even say, is the prayer of a righteous man. And James speaks of this in James 5:16. He says, "The prayer of a righteous man is powerful and effective." And I think therefore that we need to see a prayer in that way when we're praying for someone who's harmed us, because it's an unusual way to pray. It's unusual for anyone who's been harmed to want to pray for those who've harmed them. Now, to understand why God would give additional weight to the prayer of a person who's been wronged or abused, or who is then pleading with him for mercy for the wrongdoer, let's consider a legal illustration which might make it clearer. Imagine that a judge at the end of a criminal trial is hearing what's called pleas in mitigation on behalf of the wrongdoer. That means where sentence has been passed, in the sense of they've been found guilty, but now sentence is about to be passed, and before giving the sentence, the judge wants to hear from all relevant parties as to whether there are any factors that might affect the sentence that he's about to pass in any moment now. That's called a plea in mitigation. So it means the person is guilty, but here are some reasons why what they did is perhaps less blameworthy than it might otherwise have been. Now imagine that the judge, he gets speeches from the wrongdoer's own defence lawyer, and he also reads reports from maybe their social worker, probation officer, their doctor, their psychiatrist, and so on. All those, the judge will listen carefully to all of them, but it's their job to speak up. It's their job to give these kind of reports, and the judge will place a certain amount of weight on it, but he'll be keenly aware that it's their job to speak up in these situations. But the judge may therefore filter their words quite carefully and be less inclined to accept their recommendations than he would if they'd come from someone else. But what if the victim himself was to stand up in court and ask to say a few words on the defendant's behalf? So what if the injured party, the victim, was to say something like this? If he was to say to the judge, I know that this young man did wrong when he robbed me, but I personally would prefer him not to go to prison, but maybe instead to go to a drug rehabilitation unit and to resume his education as well. Would you please consider allowing that to be the sentence instead of sending him to prison? Now imagine that the victim stands up and says that after the accused has been found guilty. You can imagine a judge, on hearing that person speak in that way, that he'd listen very attentively and place a lot of weight on that plea for mercy, precisely because of who it's coming from. It's coming from the injured party. So likewise, when we pray for someone who's done us harm, who's wronged us, and we ask God to forgive them, ask God to bless them, not to judge them, to have mercy on them for what they did to us, I think we'll find that God is a very willing listener, and he'll take such a prayer extremely seriously. Now, an example of that kind of prayer is found in Paul's second letter to Timothy. He refers to certain fellow believers who've let him down by failing to stand by him when he was put on trial. They deserted him because they feared for themselves, but even as he writes about it to Timothy, Paul suddenly breaks off in the middle of his letter to utter a short prayer within the letter, and he asks that God will not hold those people responsible for what they failed to do for him, for Paul. That means that God will not charge them with it at the judgment seat of Christ. And this is what he says in 2 Timothy 4:16. He says, "At my first defense, no one took my part. All deserted me. May it not be charged against them." What he means is, may God not charge it against them at the judgment. May God not even take it into account. May he just forget all about it. Paul is saying, let God do nothing against these people on account of me. Now, consider what a great opportunity that therefore gives you to do good by asking God to forgive, to save, and generally to show mercy and grace to the people who've done you harm. And you might well see men and women in heaven one day who only had their eyes opened to understand the gospel as a result of your unselfish prayers on their behalf. Now consider how wonderful that would be. It would be a tremendous thing, and it's an opportunity we have simply by virtue of having been the victim of a wrongdoer. It puts us in that special status. And therefore, I would suggest to you that you consider using that status to become someone who prays for their enemies and prays for those who've done them harm. Now, having said all that, nobody has the right to demand forgiveness from us. So those who've done us wrong, they can't insist on being forgiven or demand it. There isn't any right for them to do that. It's simply that we have a duty to forgive them. But that duty isn't owed to them. The duty is owed to God. Now, not to them. So we sometimes come across people who do wrong to us, and then they're caught, but then they speak and act as if they have some kind of entitlement to be forgiven, as if we are obligated to forgive them. And such a person may even begin to see themselves as being wronged for not having been forgiven or for not having been excused. I've seen this, I've heard of this as well. And therefore, that person may get angry and say something like, "Well, I've said I'm sorry, why don't you get over it?" And things like this, or, you know, "You've got a duty to forgive me, it's your duty to forgive me." And I once heard of a person who'd been badly treated by a Christian, and the wrongdoer told him literally that it was it was his duty to forgive him. Now, that's technically true. It is our duty to forgive the wrongdoer, but it's not the wrongdoer's place to say that. The duty is not owed to the wrongdoer. The duty is owed to God, not to him. So the fact that the wrongdoer said something like that is actually compelling evidence of his own impertinence and falseness and lack of any real genuine remorse. Because if he had genuine remorse, he wouldn't be talking that way. In fact, I was once told of another situation where a church leader had misbehaved sexually and then announced that people were obliged to forgive him. So he was announcing this from on high, having the impertinence to teach about the subject of forgiveness in the sense that he was telling people that they should forgive him, and that was their duty biblically. So what he really meant was that he wanted to be let off and spared from the consequences of his actions. But you see the point, it wasn't his place to be preaching that about himself. And being let off in that way is not the same thing as forgiveness. And in particular, it was not his place to say what the duty of those people was, given that he himself was the wrongdoer. So, a person might feel aggrieved or alternatively because you're continuing to investigate them or continuing to complain about them or about something they've done. And I spoke earlier about this church leader called Rick, whom I had to tackle some years ago when I was chairman of the trustees of that church that he was the leader of, and how I tried forlornly to implement the Matthew 18 procedure. Now, I'd met the leader in the presence of witnesses, during which he blatantly lied to them, which I mentioned in an earlier talk. And then he said to me later, after they'd left, he said, "Can't you just let me off the hook?" And then later he added this phrase, he said, "Why don't we just draw a line under all of this?" And those are the phrases he used. But his objective was merely to be let off. He wanted to be let off for what he'd done. He saw that as being something that I was obligated to do in terms of forgiveness. He was twisting the meaning of forgiveness into letting him off. Do you see? That's not what forgiveness is about. And in particular, it wasn't his place to lay claim to any kind of entitlement to be let off or let off the hook or draw a line under it. By drawing a line under it, he meant just forget all about it. Don't keep reminding me of what I've done. Don't do anything about what I've done. But there was no repentance on Rick's part. He just wanted not to be held accountable for his own actions. And that's what drawing a line under it meant. Ever since then, I've always hated that phrase, drawing a line under it. It's not a genuine concept. It's a false thing of just forgetting about things. It's what you do instead of dealing with things. But he said these things as a request. He was requesting that I let him off the hook, but also there was a note of complaint in his voice, as if I was doing wrong for not letting him off the hook. And he saw my continued questioning of him and my unwillingness to drop the matter or to be fobbed off as if that was a kind of wrong on my part. And like the other leader above that I spoke of, who was guilty of sexual sin, Rick felt aggrieved at being held accountable for his own actions, as if that in some way holding him accountable was wrong. And he wanted to be let off, and he was almost demanding to be let off. He spoke as if he had some kind of entitlement to be forgiven. But he didn't, and we don't. None of us have an entitlement to be forgiven. None of us have any right to be forgiven, or indeed, none of us have any inherent God-given right to anything, whatsoever. The correct way to put it is that other people have a duty to forgive us, but as I say, that duty is owed to God, not to us. And therefore, when they do forgive, they're doing so in order to obey God. It doesn't create any corresponding right on our part to be forgiven, least of all to demand to be forgiven. Now, this is not just theological hair splitting about the definitions of words and so on. This has a major bearing on how we operate, which is why I give quite a lot of attention to this question of this issue of human rights-based thinking and this growing attitude of entitlement in my book 5, which is about the wicked, the fool, the simple and the wise. It's basically a book about how to become wise. Please refer to that book 5 for a fuller discussion of the significance of this mistaken thinking about human rights, which has so infected the Western world and also the church, the sense of entitlement and of having rights to things, which the Bible doesn't give. The Bible doesn't speak in terms of rights, it only speaks in terms of responsibilities, which is the exact opposite of a human rights-based approach, because human rights-based thinking puts the man at the centre, not God, and thinks in terms of that man having rights to things. God doesn't do that. God puts himself at the centre and thinks in terms of us having responsibilities to him. And that is the right way to think. Thinking in terms of rights will send you down the wrong path. Thinking in terms of responsibility and duty to God will cause you to think correctly. And the conclusions that you then form will be valid and correct and godly ones. But in any case, any person who is assertively demanding to be forgiven or asserting any kind of right to be let off is demonstrating by those very requests that their attitude is one whereby they've not adequately or genuinely repented, because if they had, their principal concern would be about the welfare and feelings of their victim, not about themselves obtaining forgiveness for themselves. So indeed, the more demanding they are, and the more unrepentant they must be. So, but nevertheless, the wrongdoer's bad attitude does not take away your duty to God, not to him, but to God, to forgive those people. But the wrongdoer's bad attitude is a factor that you can validly bear in mind when you're assessing the genuineness or otherwise of that wrongdoer's repentance or apology, or assessing whether it will be appropriate to be reconciled with him or resume a relationship of trust with them, or whether you should avoid them. It has relevance to that. It doesn't have relevance to whether you should forgive them. You should forgive them, at least in the basic sense of recusing yourself, even if their attitude is terrible, as was the attitude of Rick. Okay. Well, let's move on to another issue, which is, what if the wrongdoer is your parent? And this can be, for some, a terrible situation, where they have bitterness towards a parent who's wronged them, perhaps years ago, perhaps decades ago. It could even be an elderly person where what was done to them was many decades ago. And the wounds that can be inflicted by a parent can be especially deep, because the parent has a unique position from which they can do terrible harm. Now, thankfully, I've got no personal experience of any mistreatment by my parents, and I've got nothing to forgive them for. But that's not as normal a situation as it should be. There are many, many people who have real issues towards parents, abuse or mistreatment or neglect or wrong behaviour of one kind or another. But however, having said that, those who do have bad experiences with their parents and choose to harbour bitterness and hold a grudge towards their parent rather than forgive their parent, the sad fact is that they do great additional harm to themselves over and above what the parent did, because the bitterness causes serious problems in itself. But also another thing which such bitterness does is it prevents the person from honouring their father and mother, which God commands us to do. And it's there in the fifth commandment that we're to honour. It says, honour your father and mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. Now that's one of the commandments which is again renewed in the New Testament. So it's one to which we are subject. And there are specific blessings that come from honouring your parents, even if you feel they've harmed you. That being so, there are all the more reasons to honour our parents and forgive them, and to seek, if possible, to be reconciled with them, where possible, if they're still alive. But even if the parent is dead, you can still make a decision to forgive the parent and to honour them, because their death does not take away the need to forgive them or the ability to do so. Indeed, that's true of any person who's died, not just a parent. You can still tell God that you forgive that person and release them to him. And you should do so. And you'll benefit from forgiving them even after their death. So I particularly urge anyone who has a resentment problem towards a parent to release it to God, to forgive the parent, and to ask God to help you to honour your parents, because that will do you good, and failing to honour your parents will do you harm. Resenting your parents and being bitter towards them will do you particular harm. All right, well, let's look at the question of forgiveness within marriage, because it's a very, very important issue in that context. Now, possibly one of the stupidest lines ever spoken in a film was in a famous film from the 1970s called Love Story, where one character says, "Love is never needing to say you're sorry." Now, on the contrary, love means regularly needing to say that you're sorry. Not never, but regularly. Having said that, the reverse side of the coin is that love also means endlessly needing to accept apologies from the other spouse and being willing to grant forgiveness to that spouse. If you don't, then marriage can't survive. And perhaps the main reason why so many marriages today end in divorce is because of a chronic, ongoing failure to forgive. And that builds up with little things and little things building up and building up over the weeks and the months and the years and the decades even. And eventually it creates a vast reservoir of bitterness, all of which has been made from a multitude of small incidents of rudeness or thoughtfulness or selfishness or ingratitude or being taken for granted, each of which could and should have been dealt with at the time with both apology and forgiveness, or at least with forgiveness. Now, the two relationships in which we get to know another person's sins and weaknesses in the closest detail are probably those of husband and wife and employer and employee. Because in both of those, you get to see the other person as they really are. And that's mainly by virtue of spending so much time with them, but also because you get to see people at times of stress and pressure. Now, if we want our marriage to work, we have to learn how to repent and how to apologize, but also how to do so early and often, and so as to prevent and minimize the harm that is caused by unforgiveness and bitterness. But also, it's equally important to learn how to receive apologies and how to be a good forgiver and a good non-grudge holder, because forgiveness in marriage is vitally necessary. And it's grievous to see how many married couples there are where one or both of them is holding on to a catalogue of complaints about the other and either isn't given apologies or won't accept apologies or won't let go of past grievances. And they may have like a long list of grudges and resentments and bitternesses, and when some row crops up, then they'll be retrieving all these from a kind of mental database, which they haul out whenever there's an argument. Some of these may relate to events or words from years or even decades earlier. Now, every married couple would gain enormously from making a conscious decision to let those long lists of grievances go now. However belatedly, even if you've been handling things badly for years, deal with it now. Forgive things now. Write off all those grievances and ask God to help you not to take them back. Forgive the spouse. It's so important. And ask God to help you to do it and help you not to keep remembering and nursing the grudge. It's so important. Now, lastly, our forgiveness of somebody else can actually be like a key which opens the door for them to come to faith. It's one of the benefits that can come from forgiveness, where it actually benefits the other person. It can open the door for that person to become a Christian. Because not only can forgiveness influence other people and even soften their hearts, it also has the effect of prompting God to intervene and to open their eyes. And it's informative to consider the experience of Saul of Tarsus, who became Apostle Paul. Now, in the beginning, he hated Christianity, and he did all he could to oppose it. And one day, he came across Stephen, the first martyr, the first Christian martyr. Now, Saul of Tarsus was holding the coats of those who stoned Stephen to death for speaking about Jesus. And Saul saw Stephen die, and he also heard the manner in which Stephen died, in particular, the way that he prayed for God to forgive those who were stoning him. And it says in Acts 7:58-60, "When they had driven him out of the city, they began stoning him, and the witnesses laid aside their robes at the feet of a young man named Saul. They went on stoning Stephen as he called on the Lord and said, 'Lord Jesus, receive my spirit.' Then, falling on his knees, he cried out with a loud voice, 'Lord, do not hold this sin against them.' Having said this, he fell asleep," which is what the phrase the Bible uses for when a person dies. Now, I think there is good reason to believe that one of the ways that God answered Stephen's prayer was by forgiving and saving Saul of Tarsus, the very man who was there holding the coats. Now, instead of punishing Saul, as God could have done, God chose instead to use Saul as a mighty instrument. And Saul did more for the sake of the gospel than Stephen could probably ever have done, even if he'd lived a long life. But it didn't happen immediately. Saul continued to attack the church for a while longer. But I think it's quite likely, many people think this, that even as he was doing so, he was coming under God's conviction. Indeed, it's probably because he was coming under conviction that Saul tried so hard to resist the gospel. But God eventually broke down his resistance and made him into the great man that we now know as Apostle Paul. But that's my theory anyway. I think that Stephen's prayer may well have been answered in the life of Apostle Paul. But why can't we do the same? We can pray for those who've harmed us and maybe, quite likely, see real change come in their lives, God intervening and helping and using them in his kingdom. Now imagine how you'll feel one day on getting to heaven and discovering that some of your decisions to forgive other people, like Stephen, and to pray for them, and finding out when you get to heaven that what you did opened the door for them to believe in Jesus Christ and to be saved, and how that will make you feel at that time. And so that's an important thought to reflect on now and to bear in mind when choosing to forgive people and asking for God to help you to forgive people. Because that alone, quite apart from all the other benefits, just that alone would make it all worthwhile. Okay, well, that's all on that talk and on that series on forgiving others.